To listen to Business Movers 1 week early and ad-free, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. It's December 1989. The who's who of Manhattan have gathered in a Fifth Avenue ballroom for a holiday cherry gala. The lights are dimmed. On stage, there's a dapper man in a tuxedo giving a speech in front of the crowd. Far away from the dais, in the back of the ballroom, Sumner Redstone sits with a close associate, Martin Davis, the chairman and CEO of Paramount Communications. Sumner isn't here for the charity. He's trying to make a deal. Bored with the speaker on stage, Sumner leans in close. "Miss Martin, you given any more thought to our previous conversation?" "Sumner, cool it, would you? Tonight is supposed to be pleasure, not business." "This isn't pleasure. Come on, stop playing hard to get. What do you think of the merger?" Sumner has proposed a merger between his company, Viacom, and Martin's company, Paramount. Sumner sees it as a win-win. He believes that if Viacom's TV empire joins with Paramount's world-famous film studio, the union will be what Sumner calls a merger of equals. But Martin has concerns.
"Well, Sumner, I agree. There's a lot to like about our companies come together. But I'm not ready to commit."
"You're going to tell me why?"
"Well, Sumner, the fact is no one knows Paramount better than me. I'm not interested in giving up control of the company."
"Well, who says you have to?"
At this, Martin perks up.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"It means if we do the merger, you can stay on as CEO."
"I don't want an empty title. I want control."
"And you'll have it. You'll run Paramount as CEO, but under my guidance."
"No, and that means you'll be running it."
"We'll be running it together."
"I know you, Sumner. You don't do anything unless you're in the driver's seat. I made this company what it is today. I should be the one to take it into the future."
"Well, you're right. You've done some great things with Paramount, there's no doubt. You trimmed it down, got rid of excess fat, and focused on content. But you're smaller now. A bigger fish could gobble you up in an instant. Hell, Marty, you're not even a majority shareholder. You're vulnerable."
"I know I'm vulnerable, Sumner. I wasn't born yesterday. But like I said, I'm not interested. For now, I'm focused on doing what's right for the company."
"Marty, with all due respect, I'm what's right for the company. If the wrong investor gets his hand on Paramount, you and I both know what will happen. He'll borrow up to his eyelids to get the deal done, and then chop up the company and sell off parts to pay down the debt. Not me. I didn't do it with Viacom, and I won't do it with you."
Martin knows Sumner isn't always the most scrupulous negotiator. But on this issue, there is no doubt that Sumner is telling the truth. Martin takes a sip of his bourbon before giving an answer.
"All right, Sumner. Get your people in touch with mine, and we'll see where this thing goes."
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal, or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Martin gave Sumner the impression that he was willing to negotiate. But in reality, he had no intention of selling to Sumner, or anyone else for that matter. Because of his long history with the company, Martin wasn't ready to let go of the reins. And after rounds and rounds of negotiations, Martin eventually backed away. Sumner was left frustrated and had no choice but to give up on the idea of acquiring Paramount, at least for the moment. But soon, market conditions would force Martin back to the negotiating table.
In the early 1990s, Paramount's box office numbers began to falter, as did its stock price. Eventually, Martin was forced to come to grips with reality. A merger with Viacom was the best option for shareholders. But Sumner wasn't the only buyer who wanted to get his hands on Paramount. Not long after making a bid to acquire the movie studio, Sumner would find himself in another bidding war. But this time, Sumner wouldn't be mounting a hostile takeover. This time, he would be fighting one off. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Sumner's biggest competition for Paramount came from a businessman named Barry Diller. Diller was already intimately familiar with Paramount. He was CEO of Paramount Pictures from 1974 to 84. During his tenure, Paramount produced hit films like Saturday Night Fever, Terms of Endearment, and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. In that 10 years, Barry was the head of Paramount Pictures. But the film company was owned and controlled by its parent company, Paramount Communications. That meant, technically, Martin Davis was Barry's boss. The two men were like oil and water. Martin resented Barry for the tremendous influence he wielded at Paramount Pictures' Hollywood studio. Barry resented the power Martin held over him at the parent company and felt Martin's leadership skills left something to be desired. So in 1984, when Barry received an offer to take the top job at 20th Century Fox, he jumped at the opportunity to be free of Martin's clutches. There at Fox, Barry thrived, launching the Fox Television Network, which in turn launched hit TV shows like Married with Children and The Simpsons. Then in 1992, Barry left Fox and purchased QVC, the home shopping network. As Barry set out to transform QVC into a multimedia empire, he returned his sights to Paramount. Barry's name and influence always drew plenty of attention from the media, and it didn't take long for the press to start speculating that he might be looking to acquire the company. Martin was concerned. Paramount was his baby, and he didn't want to see it stolen away by the likes of Barry Diller. Martin felt certain that if Barry succeeded in acquiring Paramount, he'd very likely be fired. So Martin reached out to Sumner Redstone and reopened negotiations. Martin decided that he would rather hand the kingdom to Sumner than kneel at the throne of Barry Diller. So at a private dinner in April, Sumner was shocked when Martin revealed he was willing to sell the company and give up control. Over the next few months, Martin and Sumner worked to hammer out the deal in private. But soon, Barry Diller would derail those plans. Barry would do to Sumner what Sumner had done to Terry Elks, the former CEO of Viacom. He'd launch a hostile takeover of Paramount, leaving Sumner with no choice but to go on the defensive. This is the third episode in a four-part series on Sumner Redstone, A Taste of Medicine. It's July 1993, about 3 years after the start of Sumner and Martin's Paramount talks. Martin has invited Barry Diller to lunch in the dining room atop Paramount Communications' New York offices. Martin called this meeting for a very specific purpose. Now that he and Sumner have begun negotiations, Martin needs to keep his old rival at bay. As the two men take their seats, Barry leans over the side of his chair, admiring the dining room's scenic view of Manhattan.
You know, I've always admired this view you've got, Martin.
Yeah, it's something. And I guess, in a way, it's why I brought you to this meeting.
I don't know what you're talking about. The view from the top of Paramount. I don't want you to get used to it. I know you're sniffing around Paramount, and I want you to back off. I have no interest in doing business with you.
Martin, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Barry is interested in Paramount. He's been busy making preparations to mount a takeover. But he isn't ready to pull it off quite yet. Not all of the necessary pieces are in place. So until they are, Barry intends to play the fool.
Martin doesn't buy it.
Cut the crap, Barry. You and I both know you've been plotting a takeover for months. I've heard all sorts of stories about what you've been up to.
Well, the thing about stories, Martin, is that they're stories.
Who are you hearing them from, anyway?
David Geffen, for one.
Geffen is in the music business. And he doesn't speak for me. I speak for me. And let me tell you, Martin, when I have something to say to you, I will call you and say it to you.
Until then, don't believe what you hear. Martin knows in his gut that Barry's lying. Martin also knows that if Barry succeeds in acquiring Paramount, his days as CEO are numbered. If it's all a story, then that's fine. But if it's not, I want you to know that I've written the ending. I am serious. We have no interest in any deal with you. Paramount is not for sale. Barry almost laughs. Martin, well, now who's telling stories? Do you actually expect me to believe that? I know you've been talking to Viacom. Tell me it isn't true. Martin can't answer that, not without giving away that he and Sumner are close to a deal. So he ignores the question. What I do with my company is none of your business, Barry, and it never will be. I repeat, we don't want anything to do with you. Paramount is not for sale. Okay, Martin, I hear you. Whatever you say. Martin's lunch with Barry Diller in July of 1993 underscored to Martin the seriousness of the situation. Barry was coming for Paramount, and potentially for his job. In order to keep Barry at bay, Martin needed to get a deal done with Sumner Redstone as soon as possible. So within a matter of weeks, Martin and Sumner came to an agreement. In September of 1993, Sumner and Martin held a joint press conference in a boardroom at Viacom's headquarters. Sumner called the merger an act of destiny and said it would create the single most powerful entertainment and communications company in the world. At the same press event, Sumner explained that Viacom would acquire Paramount and gain control of the now merged company's board of directors. Martin would remain as Paramount's CEO, but Sumner would be in control of the new entity called Paramount Viacom International. Overall, the deal would be worth $8.2 billion, the largest merger since Time Incorporated and Warner Communications combined 3 years prior. Sumner bragged that the Paramount-Viacom merger would never be torn asunder. But even at the moment of the merger's announcement, it wasn't long before one of the reporters asked about Barry Diller. Rumors were still swirling on Wall Street that Barry was making preparations to mount a hostile takeover. Was either Martin or Sumner worried that Barry might put forward an unwanted rival bid, the reporter asked. Martin said that Sumner's bid was the only one Paramount had received and the only one it was expecting. Sumner dismissed the question outright. He insisted that Barry was an old friend who wouldn't do such a thing. Sumner chided the reporter, saying the press was creating a conflict that wasn't there. And it's true, Sumner and Barry did have a good working relationship. They crossed paths frequently over the years. But in spite of what Sumner said to the reporters, he was deeply worried that Barry might interfere. Immediately after the press conference, Sumner retreated to his office, picked up the phone, and called Barry Diller. When Barry came on the line, Sumner tried to keep it light. He joked to Barry that he had just told some reporters that Barry was his best friend in the business. Barry responded, "Well, we are good friends, no matter what QVC decides to do in the future." Hearing this, Sumner demanded to know what Barry was talking about. On the call, Barry admitted that QVC might put forward what he called a competitive bid for Paramount. Sumner was furious. He barked back, "You're just going to cost me money." On the call, Sumner did his best to intimidate Barry into backing off. But Barry refused, and the conversation ended without resolution. Sumner feared the merger was in peril. Soon, the situation would go from bad to worse. On September 14, 1993, the day after the press conference, Viacom stock suddenly began to plummet. Normally, news of an impending merger might boost the stock price, but the stock began to fall because of reports in the press that Sumner Redstone had broken the law. These reports allege that for months, Sumner has been buying up large quantities of shares in his own company, Viacom, in an attempt to artificially inflate the price of the stock and increase Viacom's value in the deal with Paramount. Because talks of the merger were not public until recently, many in the press began to suggest that Sumner had engaged in illegal insider trading. Sumner maintained that his stock purchases were all above board, that they had never occurred while there was a likelihood of a Paramount transaction. But in truth, Sumner began purchasing the shares as early as July, a few months after he and Martin resumed negotiations. Still, Sumner vehemently denied any and all wrongdoing. But what Sumner could not deny was that the fallout of the scandal was disastrous. After the insider trading story broke, Viacom stock began to fall, and with it, the value of Viacom's bid to merge with Paramount. Before the scandal, Sumner's offer was valued at $8.2 billion, But after, with much of the transaction in Viacom stock, fell to as low as $7.5 billion. Barry took advantage. Only about a week after the scandal broke, Barry's company QVC announced that it would pursue a takeover bid of its own, a bid valued at $9.5 billion, $2 billion more than Sumner's offer. This left Martin Davis in a difficult position. Martin despised Barry, but he couldn't reject QVC's bid outright. In addition to being CEO, Martin was chairman of Paramount's board, and he answered to the shareholders. In spite of his personal disdain for Barry and his preference for Sumner, Martin's job was to support the best possible deal on the table for shareholders. Soon after the QVC bid came through, Martin and the board quickly released a statement announcing they would consider the offer. That same day, Sumner received a letter from Barry. In it, Barry expressed his hope that his friendship with Sumner would not be impacted by this turn of events. Sumner was, of course, furious. As far as he was concerned, Barry, his old friend, had betrayed him. It looked like Sumner was entering yet another bidding war. In order to win this one, Sumner knew he needed more money, especially with Viacom's stock price depressed. So Sumner set out to secure backers for his bid. The bulk of his financial support came from Ninex Corp, a regional telephone company that purchased over $1 billion worth of Viacom stock. Still, Sumner knew victory would not be easily won. Like Sumner, Barry too had a sizable war chest. Barry's most significant financial backer was a powerful cable mogul named John Malone. Sumner knew Malone well. He was the CEO of Telecommunications Inc. and had a reputation as a ruthless corporate operator, someone who had earned the nickname the Darth Vader of cable. Sumner recalled that even Barry was afraid of him. Having once said of his now partner, "Everyone lives in fear of Malone." By entering into a bidding war with Barry, Sumner knew he was really facing down John Malone, unless he could figure out a way to scare Malone away from the deal. To accomplish this goal, Sumner would turn to an old trick. Malone's portfolio of cable providers carried multiple television channels Sumner owned through his Viacom networks. Sumner would use this knowledge of Barry's business and his legal expertise to argue that QVC's bid for Paramount was an attempt by John Malone to monopolize the cable industry. In late September, as Barry made preparations for the bidding war to come, Sumner prepared to wage war against John Malone in court.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
It's September 21st, 1993, in a conference room at the Viacom offices in New York City, less than a week after Sumner and Marty's joint press conference. Today, Viacom's division heads have gathered for an emergency meeting. Rumors abound that Sumner intends to take John Malone to court. Many of the division heads are worried that Sumner is making a mistake. They fear Malone will retaliate by having his cable providers drop Viacom channels like MTV and Nickelodeon. They've called this meeting with Sumner to raise their concerns. After a few tense minutes of discussion, Sumner walks into the room, a determined look in his eye.
All right, let's get started. I don't want to waste anyone's time here, so I'm going to cut to the chase. Yes, we are suing John Malone.
The division heads look rattled. Tom Freston, the head of MTV, nervously raises his hand on behalf of the group.
Sumner, I think I'll...
Speak up, Tom.
I think I speak for many here when I say that we don't think the lawsuit is a good idea. If we go after John Malone, he might drop channels. We could lose viewership. We've already had a few rough weeks on the street. We don't need any more bad news.
Sumner looks at the rest of the division heads in the room, many of whom nod in agreement. Sumner is frustrated, but he takes a deep breath and keeps his cool.
Okay, all right, I see this is a common misgiving. Okay, let me say first that I understand your concerns, but I think it's pretty clear we have the upper hand. You're right to believe that John Malone is formidable. He is. But he and the rest of the cable providers only make money if they have content people want to watch. And the last time I checked, people want to watch Viacom's content. Malone can't hit us without hitting himself. But Sumner, what if he decides it's worth it? Look, as far as I'm concerned, he's already hitting us hard enough with Showtime.
Showtime is a television network owned by Viacom. Malone's cable provider, Telecommunications Inc., has been dropping Showtime recently in favor of another movie channel, Encore, which Joe Malone owns.
Look, people, trust me. Cable providers are all the same. They enjoy the power they have, but the slightest pushback and they'll fold. If we take Malone to court, he'll back off. But it's so risky, Sumner. We have no guarantee he will back off. And if he doesn't, Tom, it's the principle of the matter, too. Paramount was a done deal, you understand? No one is going to take a dump in my mouth.
After the meeting, Tom and the rest of the division heads understood that Sumner was moving ahead with or without their support. On September 23rd, Sumner filed an antitrust suit against John Malone in the Southern District of New York. At first, many in the press wrote off the lawsuit. One reporter said that Sumner's case was nothing but a legal ploy aimed at salvaging his bid for Paramount. Many market analysts agreed, with one representative from Merrill Lynch calling the lawsuit posturing. Malone's surrogates dismissed it as well, saying Sumner's lawsuit was wholly without merit. But Sumner saw the suit as part of a larger strategy to put pressure on Malone. In addition to suing him in New York, Sumner went to Washington, D.C., where he testified before the U.S. Senate Antitrust Committee. There, he made a forceful case that Malone was using his gargantuan empire to bully, threaten, and cancel cable networks if they didn't bend to his will. Sumner's strategy worked. Malone would gain distance by selling Telecommunications Inc. to another company and unloading his 22% stake in QVC, leaving Barry without his biggest backer. Sumner Redstone looked poised for victory. But Barry did not tuck tail and turn. Instead, he quickly found other financial backers to fill the gap left by Malone, and then some. But he didn't immediately make a second offer to Paramount. Barry was angry with Sumner for moving against Malone, but he was also frustrated with Martin Davis and the rest of Paramount's board. In Barry's mind, Martin and the board were not only treating him unfairly, they were conspiring against him. Publicly, they were giving lip service to his original $9.5 billion bid, but in reality, Barry believed, they had already decided they were going to merge with Viacom, no matter what. Sumner should have recognized Barry's frustration. During the bidding war for Viacom, Sumner had believed that CEO Terry Elkes was conspiring with the Viacom board to undermine his takeover bid. Sumner responded by threatening a lawsuit. But Barry took a different approach. He decided that if the Paramount board would not treat him fairly, he would cut them out of the process altogether with a tender offer. A tender offer is a public invitation, usually made through a newspaper or online publication, inviting all stockholders of a publicly traded company to sell their stock at a premium price. And unlike many standard offers of acquisition, tender offers don't require approval of the board. So in late October, Barry sidestepped Martin and the rest of the Paramount board and made a tender offer directly to the shareholders. But for Barry to secure a controlling interest in Paramount, Barry needed to convince a lot of those shareholders to sell. In order to entice them, Barry offered $80 per share, $4 above the current market price. But they'd have to make their decision soon. Barry's tender offer came with a time limit of just 20 business days. Marty was furious, and so was Sumner. Sumner called Barry's maneuver coercive and a veiled threat. The tender offer stated that if Barry succeeded in securing a controlling interest in the company, shareholders who refused to accept his bid would not receive a cash payout after the merger, but instead their shares in Paramount would be exchanged for QVC stock. But if Sumner thought the tender offer was coercive, he also recognized its tactical value. It cut through red tape, took the issue directly to the shareholders, and put a clear time limit on the proceedings. He saw so much value in the tactic that just a few days later, Sumner made his own tender offer. He matched Barry dollar for dollar, but argued that Viacom's offer was superior by pointing out that Viacom had the most valuable and dominant networks in the world, plus cable systems and media outlets. He called QVC a 24-hour rummage sale. After Sumner's tender offer, the bidding war really heated up. Barry and Sumner raised the price multiple times. Ultimately, Barry tried to end the tender war by making an offer that he hoped was out of Sumner's reach, $90 per share. But just a few days later, Barry was flummoxed when Paramount's board issued a recommendation to its shareholders that they ignore Barry's offer and stick with Sumner. The board cited a myriad of reasons for this, but most interesting was a pending legal issue. Barry had been suspicious of Marty and the board for some time. He felt they were conspiring against him throughout the proceedings, giving Sumner preferential treatment. So shortly after submitting his high tender offer, Barry sued Paramount's board. In court, Barry argued that from the very beginning of the negotiations, Paramount's board refused to give QVC's offers fair consideration. And as a result, Barry believed, the board had failed to fulfill their fiduciary obligations to shareholders. Martin and the board rejected these claims in maintaining that all their actions had been fair. Sumner was confident Barry's case would fail, and so was Martin Davis. He was so confident that he bragged to a reporter that there was no doubt the judge would rule in Paramount's favor. But Martin's confidence was misplaced. The judge sided with Barry, ruling that Martin and the board had indeed fallen short of their responsibility to shareholders and that the process had not been equitable. The judge put Paramount on notice. Moving forward, the process would have to be fair or Paramount would suffer the consequences. But for the moment, the board didn't have much power. With two tender offers on the table, the final decision belonged to the shareholders. On December 20th, Barry raised his tender offer again to $92 per share. This time, Martin and the board were determined not to be accused of playing favorites. 2 days after Barry's new offer, they issued a recommendation to its shareholders. Because Barry's bid was the largest on the table, the shareholders should take it. Sumner was starting to sweat. The board's recommendation was non-binding, but it was bad PR for Sumner, and it gave Barry a clear advantage. Sumner's only chance of winning the tender bidding war was to beat Barry's price, but Sumner was reaching his limits. To keep bidding, he needed more money, and the clock was ticking. Barry's latest tender offer came with a new deadline, January 7th, which gave Sumner less than 3 weeks to cobble together a new bid. Sumner went to his usual financial backers and asked for more. His biggest ally, 9X, said they were tapped out and couldn't provide any more funding. Sumner was left desperate. But in his hour of need, he would find salvation in the most unlikely of places. To secure the funds required to outbid Barry, Sumner would do a deal with a rental empire called Blockbuster Video.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's January 6, 1994, in a conference room at Viacom's New York offices, mere hours before the Paramount deadline expires. Philippe Daumont, Viacom board member and general counsel, sits across the table from Wayne Huizinga, the CEO of Blockbuster Video. The two men are negotiating an emergency, last-minute merger between Viacom and Blockbuster. In 1993, Blockbuster's business is booming, and the company is flush with cash. Sumner Redstone needs that money to win his bidding war with Barry Diller, so he sent Philippe, his most trusted colleague, to close the deal. Now, Philippe and Wayne are deep into negotiations. If the two men can come to an agreement, Sumner will have the ammunition he needs to vanquish Barry. If this deal falls through and the deadline expires, Sumner will likely lose the bidding war for Paramount. But despite Philippe's best efforts, the talks have stalled because Wayne isn't fully on board. As Wayne flips through the latest deal memo, Philippe's eyes dart to the clock hanging on the wall.
Wayne, I don't mean to pressure you, but we're running out of time here.
I know.
But this is a thick deal memo, Philippe. There's a lot of lawyer speak in here.
Well, let me spare you the trouble and give you the highlights. We're estimating the value of this merger at $8.4 billion. It's mainly stock swap, but we get a little cash on top.
How much is that little?
$1.25 billion.
That's more than a little, Philippe.
Yeah, but Blockbuster gets plenty in return. 23 million shares of Viacom. Not to mention, we're going to offer your shareholders a generous stock package for each Blockbuster share they currently own.
It's a good deal for everyone all around, Wayne.
A good deal for who? Come on, don't do this to me, Wayne. We need to get this deal done now. I mean, right now.
It says here that Viacom retains 61% shareholder control.
That means Sumner calls the shots.
Yeah, Sumner will maintain a majority stake, and he'll be chairman of the board. But you get to be vice chairman, and that comes with a hefty salary. And Blockbuster gets to fill 3 of 12 seats on the board. Like I said, it's a good deal for everyone all around, Wayne.
Well, I'm giving up a lot of control here and a hell of a lot of money.
But you'd be on the inside and invested in a successful multi-billion-dollar media conglomerate, Wayne.
Yeah, but I'm not going to have any say in what happens after your deal with Paramount goes through. You'll be vice chairman.
Like I said, I won't have any say.
3 board seats doesn't give me and my people a majority. Sumner and only Sumner will be steering this ship, and you know it as well as I do. What happens if Paramount turns out to be an albatross? What if it drags the whole company down? And me and my shareholders with it?
Well, that's not going to happen.
You can't guarantee it.
Look at what you're buying into. Viacom's a powerful company with profitable assets. Paramount will be another jewel in the crown, and you and your shareholders will reap the benefit.
Well, I hope you're right. But I'd like some assurances that Blockbuster and its shareholders will be protected against the downside.
You want insurance?
Just call it whatever you like. I want to make sure if this goes downhill, me and mine are made whole.
Okay.
Well, I think there's a way we can get that done. But first, I need to talk to Sumner.
We're good.
But Philippe, like you said, clock's ticking.
Sumner was already giving up a lot to get a deal done with Blockbuster. In addition to board seats, he was handing over a substantial portion of his own stake in Viacom to Wayne and the Blockbuster shareholders. Now, Wayne was asking for more. He wanted what amounted to an insurance policy. But to Sumner, it was worth it to give Wayne peace of mind, because Sumner needed Blockbuster's cash to win the war against Barry. So at the final hour, Sumner instructed his team to figure out a way to ease Wayne's concerns. Sumner's team added one more provision to the deal, a shareholder benefit called a contingent value right. It meant that Viacom would have to pay Blockbuster shareholders an additional hundreds of millions of dollars if Viacom stock dipped below a certain threshold within 1 year of the acquisition. With the contingent value right on the table, Wayne was on board, and the deal was done in just hours to spare. At the time, Barry's standing offer for Paramount was $92 per share. With Blockbuster under his belt, Sumner would eventually raise his price to $107 per share, taking the total value of his offer to well over $10 billion. Sumner knew at that price, Barry would not be able to outbid him. But beating Barry did not guarantee victory. Sumner still needed to convince Paramount's shareholders to accept his tender offer. So Sumner further sweetened the deal. He offered Paramount shareholders a contingent value right, the same kind of benefit he had given Blockbuster shareholders, guaranteeing them a sizable payout if Viacom stock dropped below a certain level within the first year. In mid-February, after an exhausting months-long battle, Sumner received word that exactly 50.1% of Paramount shareholders had accepted his offer. Paramount was his. Upon hearing the good news, Sumner stood up and made a toast. He kept it simple, returning to the theme that had defined his entire career. Sumner raised his glass and said, "Here's to us who won." Sumner was eager to get his hands on the heart and soul of the company, Paramount Pictures. Like he had done with Viacom years prior, Sumner wanted content to drive Paramount's growth into the future. so he gave the studios wide latitude to make and distribute films as they saw fit. The result was a string of critically acclaimed box office hits, films like Titanic and Saving Private Ryan. Over the years, Sumner was certain content was king, and he pursued that idea by implementing an aggressive vertical integration strategy. In just a few decades, Sumner transformed National Amusements from a theater exhibition company into a media empire, a powerful holding company that owned Viacom and now Paramount. But Sumner was just getting started. Just a few years later, in 1999, National Amusements would acquire CBS in what would be the largest media deal in history in its time. But Sumner's success would have unintended consequences. At the time of the Paramount merger, Sumner was 70 years old. Many of his backers were concerned and wanted to make sure Sumner had a long-term plan for Viacom in the event that he passed away. To allay these concerns, Sumner handed over his succession plan, which stated that in the event of his death, the new chairman of Viacom would be Philippe Dumont. To Sumner, Philippe seemed like an obvious choice. He had been with Sumner since the Viacom acquisition, and over the years, he'd proven himself more than capable. But not everyone shared Sumner's enthusiasm for Philippe, including members of the Redstone family. This succession plan would spark a decades-long power struggle in a family business that would ultimately pit father against daughter. From Wondery, this is episode 3 in our 4-part series on Sumner Redstone for business movers. On the next episode, Sumner's decision to name Philippe as his successor sets him on a collision course with his own daughter, Sherry Redstone. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about Sumner Redstone, we recommend The King of Content by Keech Hagee and A Passion to Win by Sumner Redstone. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Dante Flores. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.